It's so brand new, you see. People don't realize the whole thing started almost overnight by Archie at Eastminster. He'd already been starting anyway all sorts of innovations. That's why we call ourselves guinea pigs at Eastminster.
When the Guinea Pig Club was formed by a group of men who'd suffered horrific burn injuries in the Second World War, they thought they were creating a drinking club among friends. But 80 years on, their legacy has been so much more than that. The Guinea Pig Club was a group of just under 700 men who had all survived the unsurvivable when they suffered life-changing injuries and severe burns during the Second World War. They were all treated by the pioneering plastic surgeon Sir Archibald Mackindoe at a small cottage hospital in the south of England. Their experimental treatment has transformed plastic surgery, and their spirit has inspired countless others who have faced what feel like insurmountable challenges. Although only six members of the club survive, the group's contribution to medical knowledge continues even today. Welcome to the final episode of this special mini-series of the All Stations podcast from the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund. I'm Victoria Taylor, a military historian specialising in British and German aviation. In this series, we've already heard the incredible story of how the Guinea Pig Club came about and how they've inspired the survivors of modern conflicts, including the foundation of the Kazifak Club for service personnel who suffered extreme injuries in Iraq and Afghanistan. In this episode, we're diving into the medical legacy of both clubs and hearing from a plastic surgeon who has treated more veterans of the Afghan conflict than any other in the UK. The members of both the Guinea Pig Club and the Kazifak Club were united by the severity of their injuries, injuries that had previously been unsurvivable. The intense heat and fire of aircraft crashes caused horrific burns and related injuries for Guinea Pig Club members, while in Afghanistan and Iraq, blast and gunfire injuries caused extensive scarring and resulted in the loss of limbs for some men and women. Remarkable rescues and advances in emergency treatment meant the seriously injured could survive. But for both groups, that was only the beginning of their recovery, because there was no blueprint for living the rest of their lives after surviving the unsurvivable. Not only the patients, but their doctors, surgeons, and physiotherapists had to be experimental, trying things that had never been done before. Collectively, they became experts in treating those injuries. 80 years ago, at the Queen Victoria Hospital in East Grinstead, Sir Archibald Mackindoe was working with patients who had sustained terrible burn injuries. They were missing fingers, thumbs, eyelids, and noses, parts of the body essential for function. He had to find creative new methods to give his patients the ability to pick things up, blink, or smell again. Mackindoe developed a technique called the tube pedicle graft, which allowed him to graft a piece of skin into a tube from one part of the patient's body, and then, across a number of weeks, he'd waltz this piece up the body until it reached the area it would be used to reconstruct the new feature. Thomas Gleave was chief guinea pig. In an interview with the Imperial War Museum in 1986, he explained how a pedicle graft worked.
Could be from the back, could be from the chest. You run your scalpel down and raise this piece of skin like that and put some wadding underneath and leave it. And after a while, the blood is running up and down both ways. Nature gives it a new blood supply. When it looks okay, you cut one end of it, lift it up, and you pull all the rest of it together and sew it up. Very soon that stretches and you won't see it. Then with this long thing you've got now, you turn it into a tube. Just bend it around to a tube and stick the other end onto your face, wherever the nose is going. See? And let that take root. Then when that's taken root, you cut this end off. And you put it over the nose. There you go, new nose. And they do this for all sorts of things, for a new jaw or top lip.
Ian Anderson was another member of the Guinea Pig Club. He sat in on his friend's surgery, something Mackindoe encouraged the patients to do.
I saw a friend of mine having his eyelids done. He'd been badly burned. As you probably know, if the loss of eyelids is quite serious, if it's not done as an emergency operation, you can go blind. And it was quite remarkable. He took the skin from the pit of his stomach, used the pubic hairs as eyelashes, and he had the stitches out and the eyelids working within about 7 days. As far as I know, this chap's still using them. A lot of the operations he did, in fact, for those days, I think, were quite miraculous. And, of course, there was all this experimentation was going on the whole time. It was, hence the term guinea pig. I mean, I didn't feel squeamish about it. By this time, I'd seen so many gruesome sights in the hospital that that was minor by comparison, you know.
As we heard in previous episodes, the guinea pigs went on to thrive despite their injuries, and their sense of expertise in and ownership of their treatment through all the years that followed played a major part in that. But their experimental treatment didn't just save their own lives. Of course, conflict injury is really at the most extreme end of the scale, and very few people in civilian life will suffer the types of injuries that the guinea pig and Casifat Club members have endured. But that doesn't mean that the knowledge learned from their treatment can't be passed down into more everyday applications, as medical military historian Emily Mayhew explains.
We really have plastic surgery as a separate discipline because of the Guinea Pig Club, because there was this single place where there was this emphasis on the repair of the most difficult functional areas on the human body. So they became really technical experts. Plastic surgery itself has become a very specialised practice, and you have people who do only hand surgery, where they repair the soft tissue, but also bones and cartilage, tendons and ligaments of fingers to make the fingers as functional as possible. Because we still understand that if you need a pinch, if you have nothing else left, you need a pinch. We still transplant toes from the foot up to the hand so that you can have a thumb that is in fact a toe. We still do that. Everything that's technical and extraordinary about plastic surgery today, we learned that has its roots in East Grinstead. And so we must be extraordinarily grateful to Mackindoe. Mackindoe, his anaesthetist, his physios and his nurses, because they understand that it's a process.
In the last episode, we heard how the example of the Guinea Pig Club paved the way for the Casifat Club. And the two clubs share this element of pioneering medical knowledge.
With the Casifat Club, we've understood a number of things that are equally important as the development of plastic surgery. We've understood that with blast injury, with the kind of injuries that are experienced and survived, the closer treatment is brought to the point of wounding, the more likely someone is to survive. But I think the most significant equivalent is this understanding of physiotherapy, is the understanding that that's where the work's going to be done. The surgery is just a start. It's what people do with the repair that is fundamental. The development of a physiotherapy multidisciplinary team that tackles prosthetics, that tackles pain, that deals with family, that deals with perception and the mental health outcomes of these injuries.
As Emily points out, along with the surgical advancements made through the treatment of service personnel, huge progress was made in the way patients were treated holistically. Sir Archibald Mackindoe became legendary for his approach to caring for his patients' mental health. He was intent that in allowing his patients to become experts in their own conditions, they would be able to take control of their own healing, inside and out. We heard Ian Anderson earlier talking about watching a pedicle graft operation. Mackindoe encouraged the men to observe each other's surgery so they could understand better what was happening to them. Here's head guinea pig, Thomas Gleave, explaining just how much he broke down the barriers of what was considered to be correct care.
Archie broke every well-known hospital rule. He had no time for the old-fashioned hospital rules. This silly military idea of lying to attention, all that nonsense, whatever that thing. If you didn't want to wake up in the morning, you didn't wake up. You may have had an op the day before, or you're going to have an op 2 days' time. Just leave them alone. Feed them well. I used to spend my time in the theatre. Archie used to invite us into the theatre, those who wanted to go, and I used to dress up. It's in between my own operations, and I just sit with him in the theatre. And when he's doing a job, he loved doing his patter. Being a brilliant surgeon, he's also a brilliant lecturer. And up in the galleries, of course, there are always people watching. You know, but he used to sit with Archie. He used to like to be invited because he always reckoned he gave us confidence in the whole of the idea, whole of the operation.
In building a relationship with each patient, McIndoe was able to encourage young men who'd experienced life-changing and what in many cases would have felt like life-ruining injuries, feel they could trust him and that things would get better. It's something which is still a core principle for surgeons working with seriously injured servicemen and women today. Alexandra Crick is a plastic surgeon who has operated on more service personnel injured in the Afghan conflict than any other UK surgeon. She has performed reconstructive surgeries on many of the Kazifat Club, including senior aircraftman Mike Goody, who we heard from in the last episode. We'll hear from Alex herself in a moment, but let's hear from Mike first.
Meeting Alex Crick and being put in touch with her right from the meeting with her to start with, she's so approachable, easy to talk to, and just fantastic. You know, it was everything was explained in such great detail, and you know, sort of looking back comparatively, it was like, wow, I've never had this. You know, I can't even blame, you know, the drugs I was on initially of confusing and muddling my mind up or anything. There is no comparison, if I'm brutally honest. And it's just amazing and what she does and how she does it, right through to, you know, when you're laid on the table and they're putting the anaesthetic into you. She's there talking to you, smiling at you and making sure you're okay. And it's amazing. It's absolutely unbelievable. She's an absolute legend of a woman.
Alex wasn't the first surgeon to treat members of the Kazifat Club. She met most of them for the first time around a year after they had returned to the UK with their injuries. But she has been instrumental in their reconstructive care and recovery and has continued to treat many of the group for over a decade. I sat down with Alex to discuss her work. I began by asking her about that initial meeting with a patient.
The first meeting is really, really important. It may be the first time that somebody's met a surgeon having been injured and had all the surgery that entails initially, and for them to submit themselves to further surgery, it does require trust. It's a leap of faith. They have to trust that you have their best interests at heart and that you know what you're doing and you're going to do your best for them. So there's that trust element as well as the sort of practical problem of trying to work out what you can offer them surgically, if anything. And if you've been injured in that way, if you've been blown up, you may have maybe lots of parts of you that are missing, and what remains, a lot of those areas may be injured. So you are running out of the spare parts. And together with the patient, you work out what troubles them, what their priorities are. And as a surgeon, you can work out what you can make better, what's technically possible, given what's available. And then you come up with a plan between you, and it may require more than one admission, more than one operation. So you work out what you want to do, in what order, in what combinations, mm-hmm. with what intervals and so on.
Could you outline the type of injuries that you tend to see? I know every single person is unique, their circumstances are unique, their how they respond to what's happened is different. But is there any sort of pattern in the injuries that you see that come into your clinics and to the hospitals?
So the most common injury was blast injury from improvised explosive device detonation, most commonly on foot, but occasionally in a vehicle. And there are particular patterns of injury. So amputation, significant amputation was frequent, particularly lower limb. So either one limb, two lower limbs, maybe a third. Most commonly, the right upper limb, because of the way, if you're right-handed, that's how the weapon's held. So that makes that limb more vulnerable to injury. And then there's the consequences of that immediate damage control surgery that they would have had while in Afghanistan at the Field Hospital in Camp Bastion, and then subsequently at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham, that were required to save their life, to control bleeding, for example. So they may have other problems that you have to take into account. So the tourniquet can create an injury, the surgery within the groin or the lower abdomen to control bleeding, areas that have been used for skin graft or pedicled flaps. Together, this gives you a sort of a familiar constellation of injuries that you're dealing with.
And of course, these are injuries which previously people hadn't survived. Thanks to the casualty evacuation process in place now, they're able to get the specialist treatment quickly, which of course leads to a long process of reconstruction, rehabilitation and recovery. What's it like to be a surgeon at the front of these experimental surgeries?
You feel very responsible because, first of all, they've been through so much already and they have decided to trust you. You know, obviously they have things that are troubling them physically that they would, in an ideal world, like improved, and they've decided to trust you to help them achieve that. And if they have lots of things that you think you might be able to address surgically, we mentioned spare parts already. They are sometimes very short of spare parts. And I've undertaken my share of microsurgery for trauma or secondary problems of trauma. But these were a very special group because if I was planning a microsurgical procedure, that one flap that I was aiming to transfer microsurgically to reconstruct a particular problem, I knew that it would have to work because there wasn't a plan B. So they present a very special challenge surgically because they're complex given the extent and the nature of their injuries, the number of their injuries, and the number of problems that you would like to address for them. So that the challenges are in the planning, and then the plan has to work. So everything you do has to work.
Yeah, and I assume you feel even more pressure, not just for you, but for your patient, you know, sort of thinking where that's going to lead and what the options are, if indeed there are any options after that process.
Absolutely. So it's, you really want it to work. If you have a lot of very extensive injuries in that way, and particularly when it comes to pain or difficulty with your prosthetic rehabilitation, any small improvement would be viewed as really worthwhile. And that's what you really want for them. So yes, you have to take it personally, I think, so that you and the patient knows that you're doing your very best.
What are the challenges involved in trying to balance restoration of physical functionality with surgery for appearance? So do the two types of procedures often clash with each other and complicate your treatment of a patient?
That is an excellent question.
Okay.
And appearance, I mean, that's what people think of when you talk about plastic surgery. They think about cosmesis. Most of what we do is about getting difficult wounds healed, restoring function or preserving function. But appearance really matters, and it matters in an unexpected way. And it can often be a side effect of what you're doing to improve function. But appearance in this group of patients really does matter because they are often conscious of their appearance, and it is often a very welcome side effect of what I'm doing to restore function, that the appearance will be improved. And for some parts of you, such as your face, your hands, which are very, because they're on show, they're very cosmetically sensitive. You know, we can all understand why it would make a difference if those injuries were improved in their appearance and more natural less distracting because you've got less to explain when you're interacting with other people. But appearance of those areas that are also normally hidden matters because that affects how you feel about yourself as well. And that includes a residual limb that is most of the time hidden inside a socket. So having a residual limb with a smooth contour and tidy scars, you know, you can imagine how that would be preferable. Appearance is part and parcel of what we do as a specialty, but even when we're undertaking secondary reconstruction for the effects of trauma, it's often a side effect of what we do, but it's a very welcome one.
Lots of these patients are people you'll see for years and years. Their injuries are ongoing and not an easy fix. What is that like as a surgeon? It's usually quite unusual for someone to have multiple ongoing surgeries with one surgeon, as I understand it.
That is particularly true of my specialty, but it's one of the features of my specialty that particularly appeals to me. So I know if I meet maybe a civilian who's just been injured with very severe extensive combination of injuries or sepsis or anything significant like that, and I know that I will see a great deal of them, including theatre, for weeks for that first admission, if not months, and then it is likely that they will require or benefit from secondary surgery, which take place over a period of years afterwards. And then, depending on how severely injured they are, it may be that I need to be in touch with them pretty much for the rest of their life or be available to them anyway. But you develop, it's an unusual relationship because of that prolonged contact and the significance you have in their life as well.
That holistic response in terms of a long-term relationship with patients was practiced heavily by Sir Archibald Mackindoe, and his dedication to it was evident in the success of the Guinea Pig Club in their recovery. Where do you find similarities of treating your patients with Mackindoe's own experiences with the Guinea Pig Club?
When I hear or read about what Mackindoe did, it does remind me in some ways of my own experience. And it's the intensity of that surgeon-patient relationship, because your treatment extends over a period of weeks, months, if not years. And the Guinea Pig Club itself, that sort of kinship amongst those who are injured, it's the way they've been injured, their experience after being injured, their experience of the surgery that they had to go through to be as good as they could be. And broadly, their military experience is a very powerful reason to prefer each other's company. And you've touched on the Kazovac Club, which is also similar but different, because they're united by, as a sort of entry criteria, they have to have been Kazovac from Afghanistan, which implies a certain severity of injury. But it's similar in that in each other's company, there's a lot that can be left unsaid.
Yes, and I wondered also what the presence of a club like the Kazovac Club or the Guinea Pig Club means for your work. Do you find that the members compare notes or that you're able to approach their needs differently? Mackindoe encouraged his men to spectate on the surgeries of others. Would that be something you'd ever consider?
No, in terms of somebody watching somebody else's surgery. Surgical theatres were called theatre because they were literally a theatre originally. So people that were training would watch somebody else undertaking surgery. And there are lots of people in theatre, and it often surprises patients when they come into theatre exactly how many people there are in there looking after them. And I do take a lot of photographs if the patient wishes, which I can share with them. A lot of people ask, would I mind taking a video, which I'm less inclined to do, but I can share photographs with them, and I think it really helps. It helps in a number of ways. It helps the patient have a better idea of what has happened to them while they're asleep. And from my selfish point of view, it means they have a better idea of why I'm asking them to look after themselves in a particular way. So it helps us both understand what's been done and why they need to look after themselves in that way afterwards. And, you know, so much the way they were injured and the way they were cared for immediately is not in their control. And it's everybody prefers to have a sense of control, and having an idea of what you've done while they're asleep is maybe matters for that reason.
Like Mackindoe, your work has been heavily informed by unforeseen injuries caused by conflict. Clearly, conflict and the injuries that happen as a result are best avoided where possible. But can you explain what the Iraq and Afghan wars have contributed to medical knowledge?
They've contributed hugely to medical knowledge, and I would argue that's probably the most significant legacy of those conflicts, is how it's improved our care of trauma in the UK, and therefore will save many lives for years to come. And that experience has influenced how we manage trauma in many ways. And that includes most immediately the importance of the control of blood loss, for example, and how we rapidly image those patients and damage control surgery, that concept being revisited again, and how we manage the use of blood products for replacement. So that's already happened. The advent of the major trauma centre, that was largely a consequence of our experience with those injured in Afghanistan. The advantage of the major trauma centres is that you concentrate the expertise. So rather than a severely injured patient going to the closest hospital, they are now triaged pre-hospital and will go to specific hospitals that are designated major trauma centres, where you have concentration of the right expertise. And we know that having the right team makes such an important difference to the outcome. And immediately the major trauma centres were developed and in place, we saw an increase in survival. So the NHS was seeing its own unexpected survivors. We haven't extrapolated everything that we've learnt from Afghanistan. And I think the biggest area where we haven't done that and where we could is with what we've learned from the rehabilitation and our experience with our war injured passing through DMRC at Headley Court and now Stanford Hall, and being able to translate that more completely to the NHS, more broadly speaking. So there's so much that we've learned, and there is more that we could learn for the benefit of everybody in the UK.
What are your hopes for future medical developments and improvements?
I think the most pressing task in the next few years is for us to better organise healthcare, both physically and psychologically, for this particular group of individuals. We're not talking about a very large number of people who are injured in this way, and we're very good at remembering those that have given their lives, as we do with Remembrance Day. And it's a question I'm often asked, actually. You know, the Afghan conflict happened a while ago now. Why do you still need to run these clinics? Why are you still seeing those patients as veterans? And it's important for us as a nation to remember those who've been injured, because these are life-altering injuries. And although once you're injured and you have a whole series of operations and you start your rehabilitation and you might have further secondary surgery during that rehabilitation, it's likely that if you were injured in that way, you are going to need medical support for the rest of your life, potentially by people who understand your injuries or have some expertise in that.
Patient confidentiality is obviously very important, but are there any recovery stories that really stuck with you and changed your outlook on life at all?
The best answer to that is to say that I feel my job has meant that I have rubbed shoulders with some incredibly impressive individuals, and I'm not sure if I'd like to identify one in particular, because there have been so many that, and they're so impressive because of the way they have weathered all that's happened to them and what they have done subsequently despite that, despite the physical and psychological injuries that they sustained. So I feel very fortunate to have known them.
The Guinea Pig Club members never asked to be the subject of medical experimentation. But thanks to the legendary work of their surgeon, Sir Archibald Mackindoe, they showed that not only was life after unsurvivable injury possible, but that their experiences could help others too. In more recent years, CASIFAC Club members have followed suit, offering themselves up for innovative new surgeries and treatments. In fact, as Mike Goody says, it's one of their main goals to reduce suffering for other survivors of serious injury.
It's unfortunate that, you know, conflict causes injuries like this. But on the silver lining to that aspect is modern day medicine has people to trial on. And if by trialing on us and things start working and, you know, it drifts down into, you know, general medicine, as it were, then why wouldn't we?
I open this series by saying that when the Guinea Pig Club formed, they were at the start of a long battle for recovery. That is true, but the 80 years that followed were also a display of their principles. Bravery, camaraderie, and despite everything, great joy and laughter. Across the decades, and in very different circumstances, those principles have gone on to inspire the members of the CASIFAC Club as they have faced huge adversity. We end this special series as we started it, with the determined, joyful voices of the Guinea Pig Club singing their anthem of resilience, and hope that you too have been inspired by their incredible legacy.
Goodbye, men of East Grinstead Hospital, and good luck. We shall remember you.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund, the Royal Air Force's charity supporting those who are serving or have served in the Royal Air Force and their families when they need it most. We provide the financial, emotional, and practical support that helps people live with the dignity and independence they deserve. We rely on the generous donations of people like you to ensure that we can continue to be here for as long as they need us. If you'd like to find out more about the Guinea Pig Club and how the fund supports members of both the Guinea Pig Club or the CASIFAC Club, or to donate, please check out our website, refbf.org. This series is a Chalk and Blade production, brought to you by the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund. This episode was presented by me, Victoria Taylor. The producer is Rosie Stopher. The mix and theme music are by Alex Portfelix, and the executive producers are Laura Sheeter and Fiona Ferguson. The oral history clips of Guinea Pig Club veterans are courtesy of the Imperial War Museum, and the archive clip of the Guinea Pig anthem is courtesy of the BBC. A special thank you to our contributors, Dr. Emily Mayhew, Alexandra Crick, and Royal Air Force veteran and Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund ambassador Mike Goody.